A former Boeing pilot has been charged in the first MAX criminal prosecution. And we'll go to the Reporters' Roundtable with Crane's political columnist Greg Hines and government reporter A.D. Quigg to talk about news from the state and local political beat.
Most people who've lived here for a while know Illinois has just missed the boat on big economic development after big economic development for 40 or 50 years.
I want to ask you what the political appetite is for incentives in the General Assembly these days, because I think everyone thinks of Foxconn, and everyone thinks a few years back to the controversy over EDGE tax credits.
I'm Amy Guth, and this is Crane's Daily Gist for Monday, October 18th. When it comes to a professional like your doctor or lawyer, you want someone who knows you well. Wintrust believes you should have the same relationship with your banker, someone you can call directly and know they'll understand your concerns. Thousands of local business owners called their Wintrust banker when they needed Paycheck Protection Program loans. They called, Wintrust answered, and helped more than 11,000 local businesses secure funding. Learn more at wintrust.com/dailygist. Member FDIC. So welcome to the Reporters Roundtable. I've got Crane's political columnist Greg Hines and Crane's government reporter A.D. Quigg with me today. So let's dive right in. We've got so many things to talk about. You two are both kind of like reporting machines. Good grief. So Greg, let's start with you. Let's start with the congressional map. What update can you give there?
Well, as of this recording, we're recording this on Friday, everybody is expecting the new map is going to come out Friday evening. That's how the Democrats who had run the show in Springfield handled the state map. They tried to do what we in the business call a news dump, put it out at a time when nobody's watching, except everybody's going to be watching. And the real question here is whether the Democrats indeed are going to do what everybody suspects they're going to do, which is try to increase, add one additional seat in the state to their majority while simultaneously losing a seat that would come out of the Republican side. So essentially, the Democrats would pick up one seat, the Republicans would lose one seat. That's the initial buzz as to what's going to happen. And their heads are most definitely on the chopping block, it would appear, are Adam Kinzinger, who is the only Republican to represent any part of the Chicago area, and a downstate congressman named Rodney Davis. And indeed, if their districts disappear or if they're mapped in the unwinnable territory, the question then becomes, what, if anything, do either of them do about it? Both have threatened to run for governor. Kinzinger has threatened to run for senator against Tammy Duckworth, which is up next year. But we'll see. But we'll get a better idea later today.
Also, looking on the state level, Pritzker has been talking a little bit about electric vehicle infrastructure and passenger rail stuff. What can you tell me about that?
Oh, he's been talking about that a lot. The backstory here is that as most people who've lived here for a while know, Illinois has just missed the boat on big economic development after big economic development for 40 or 50 years. We used to be the appliance production capital of America. You could say in some ways that big parts of the computer were invented here. Lots of biotech stuff developed here early and then moves to the coast. We continue to miss the boat because we haven't done the kinds of things that are necessary. Well, we now have this dramatic new industry that's really perking along. It's called electric vehicles because Detroit has signaled that Elon Musk was right, that electric vehicles and not gasoline cars are the future. So Detroit's in a rush to reposition itself and refashion its factories and so forth. And fortunately for Illinois, we actually have a presence there. The old Mitsubishi plant in Bloomington Normal is now run by Rivian, which is a electric truck producer. We have a bus producer that moved into Chicago. We have a lot of battery research that comes out of Argonne National Lab. So Pritzker wants to seize on that. So he is proposing, and in the same special session, same veto session of the legislature this week, that in which the maps may come up, he's going to ask the legislature to approve this huge incentive package that may be the biggest incentive package in state history. Hundreds of millions of dollars potentially, income tax breaks, sales tax breaks, utility tax breaks, lots of stuff. The aim is to get those cars, and in particular, a big battery factory that Samsung is poking around the country to build. The insiders tell me we're in a race with Ohio. They're the main competition, but you're talking 7,500 jobs and millions of square feet of factory. That's a huge prize. It would put Illinois on the map. It would give us a lasting stake in this new emerging industry. And that's what Pritzker wants to do.
I want to ask you what the political appetite is for incentives in the General Assembly these days, because I think everyone thinks of Foxconn and everyone thinks a few years back to the controversy over EDGE tax credits. Like, where do you think the General Assembly is on big incentive packages like this?
That's a good question, AD. The Republicans will kind of have to be for it, most of them will, whether they say or not, because there's Republicans in the state are still the party of business. This helps business. The Democrats are a little more difficult, but the insiders I've talked to tell me that there probably will be support for this, that all these jobs and the money is a real lure. But they have to be some precautions built into this. Clawback, for instance, if we give incentives and we don't get the jobs, we get the money back or something to prevent the money from going out the door in the first place. That's what happened up in Wisconsin with Foxconn. And the other thing is there are going to be some gifts to organized labor, which really has tremendous.
That always helps.
Yeah, you know Springfield as well as I do. At the moment, it looks like the only gift in the legislation is a requirement, effectively, that the people building the factory have to be union labor and not the people inside. But there have been some other signs in the tech area that the unions want to get a foot into the people in the factory as well. That would probably blow the thing up. Most of these electric vehicle plants, particularly Teslas, are not unionized. And we'll see how far the unions want to push. But that's the other thing to keep an eye on.
To back up a little to Rivian, I think it was so fascinating recently to get kind of a peek at Rivian's financial picture for a company that hasn't delivered a vehicle yet. They have, you know, the Amazon contract to deliver their electric vehicles, but yet we saw this clause that Amazon doesn't have to, you know, is really under no obligation to take them. I thought that was like such an interesting, Rivian is just such an interesting organization to look at.
Yeah, I mean, all the normal rules of economics go out the window when you talk about tech companies. You run up huge losses. You do it for years and years, but you want to get market share. That's what Rivian is trying to do, and they're trying to establish it early. We'll see if the numbers work out for them. In Amazon's case, the numbers worked out brilliantly. They lost money for years, and now they're among the most profitable companies on the planet. I mean, Jeff Bezos could—he's flown Bill Shatner up into Captain Kirk up into space for free. He got plenty of dough. I think the best indication, Amy, of how real this is that Rivian continues to hire people like mad down in Bloomington. Less than a year ago, they only had like 800 people. They're up to 3,000 this week, the local media has been reporting. They're talking about 4,000 to 5,000 a year ago. If you don't have money and somebody isn't buying your products, you don't do stuff like that.
Yeah, that is a good indicator. All right, I'm going to bring up a topic that you both have been covering quite a bit, and that is the city budget. So, Greg, let's start with you. You recently wrote about how Chicagoland Chamber of Commerce CEO Jack Lavin has been pushing back on the city budget. What can you tell me about that?
This city budget was pretty much balanced on the back of federal taxpayers. Lori Lightfoot was lucky, like Tony Prekwick, with the head of the county board. She got a ton of money from the latest federal COVID relief plan, and a good chunk of it is going this year. And there's been a bit of a food fight over how to spend it. Big surprise, people fight over how to spend money. A lot of aldermen, for instance, want more money to go into a violence reduction than she's been spending. They're pleased she's spending a lot on things like low-income housing and so forth. Well, the business guys feel they haven't gotten their fair piece, particularly since the budget also includes $76 million in property tax increases, despite all this big federal dough. In particular, the hospitality industry, the hotels, the restaurants still are just starting to get back close to where they were. They've lost a ton of money. They have a long, dark winter ahead of them. They want part of this money. The mayor hasn't said yes yet, although there's some talks going on. There's also, and I know AD has some thoughts on this, the continuing concern about crime, which is just, it seems to be whatever the mayor says, out of control right now, at least in terms of violent crime. That's the underpinning of this drama that's been unfolding over all weekend over whether Chicago police are going to effectively go on strike or have the blue flu because of these new COVID restrictions. Much of Chicago is just scared to death right now because violent crime not only is at high level, but it spread from areas of the West and South sides that have had these kind of crime levels into the North side, into wealthier neighborhoods. Maybe it's good that people who live up there, including me, get a taste of what they've been putting up with on the South and West side for years. But it has people really scared. It is a staggeringly big issue. And that's the real issue the business guys are concerned about, I think, as much as the money.
AD, you have also been covering the budget quite a bit more recently about how the Civil Federation has been pushing back on the budget as well. What do you have to share there?
Yeah, the Civic Federation has always been kind of the outside independent group that aldermen go to say, hey, is this budget actually a good idea? Lawrence Mazzal testified very briefly at City Council this week saying, you know, we support the city's use of federal dollars in this way. We don't have a good sense of what the city's long-term plan is after that money runs out. The same things that plagued the city pre-COVID are still going to plague them after, which is pensions and debt. And the Civic Fed basically wants the city to say, here's our plan for addressing this down the line. Because as we know, the city is spending down a vast majority of its federal dollars in this budget and applying a lot of it to past budgets. Pension costs are over $2 billion a year. Those are more, they're not going to increase in the same way they have been in the past about 5 years, but it's still a huge chunk of money. And when you pay pension costs at that level, it means you're shoving out other city services you could be spending that money on. So Civic Fed wants some kind of plan for addressing that and for the city's big debt burden. The city says it's beginning to pay off scoop and toss debt that was undertaken in past administrations. If Chicagoans know anything, it's that scoop and toss debt is bad. The city says we're climbing that ramp, we're addressing it. And as we address it, it's going to free up more money in the budget to provide city services. But I will be so fascinated, as the Civic Fed is, to know whether the recovery in Chicago actually happens in 2022 and 2023 to support the level of spending that they're forecasting. If the recovery isn't as robust, the city's going to be in a lot of trouble.
AD, did the Civil Federation usually tends to be pretty cautious. It strikes me that this report was cautious. Did they pull a punch here? I know Paul Vallis, the former city budget director, former Mayor Kenna, has been screaming all week about how we should have put some of this money into paying down the pension debt. The Civil Federation didn't talk about that. They just said, we got to deal with it later.
Right. They're always cautious. I think they try to maintain a good relationship with the city council and the mayor. And this warning is very similar to the warning they gave to CPS saying, hey, this money's going to run out and the problems that predated COVID are going to be at your doorstep next budget. Pulling a punch, I don't know. It's politically risky to go after the mayor too hard, as you're aware. She likes to punch back.
If you're a watchdog, isn't that what you're supposed to be doing?
Yeah.
AD, you've also been reporting a lot about the city vaccine requirement and how that is playing out with the Chicago police. What is the latest there?
Every day, something new on this. Yeah. So the October 15th is the deadline that the mayor set for City of Chicago employees to report their vaccination status. There's an online portal where if you're a city employee, you're supposed to say, I'm vaccinated or I'm unvaccinated. If you're vaccinated, you're good to go. If you're unvaccinated, you are subject to biweekly testing at your own expense. If you don't report, you will be put on non-disciplinary no-pay status. And the unions that have pushed back the most on this are police unions, specifically the Fraternal Order of Police Lodge 7, which has been fighting with the mayor
about everything
for the past 2 years plus, about everything, but especially about this. The latest is on Friday, Mayor Lori Lightfoot asked her law department to file suit in Cook County Court for injunctive relief against the FOP. And it's President John Catanzara for engaging in, supporting, and encouraging a work stoppage or strike. So basically, the language coming out of the FOP this week was that you do not have to report your vaccination status. When you don't do that, the city is basically going to send you home. And if enough of us do that, The city won't be able to maintain its police force to fight the crime that Greg was talking about. And they'll basically cede and say, no, it's okay, you don't have to report your vaccination status. So basically a game of chicken where do the cops show up, do the cops submit, or does the city let up and say, you can have more time to get vaccinated? I'm interested in Greg's thoughts on how this is playing out politically. It's good for John Catanzaro with his members to be punching at the mayor. I think it's good for the mayor to be punching back at the union and saying, we are doing this to protect our city workforce, to protect the public that interacts with the city workforce. But I'm curious for Greg's thoughts on how this is going to play out politically.
I think you're right, AD. It is a mutual game of chicken. I suspect that if this was July and the weather was hot and people were in prime gangbanging season, this wouldn't be happening quite as much. You know, in the end, are that many individual officers really willing to risk losing their job effectively over this vaccine stuff? Or is it just the hardcore, you know, pseudo Trump, nobody tells us what to do kind of expressions that are coming from Catanzaro? I mean, he got elected, which tells me something. But I don't know if they're going to follow it out. But there's no question there is a risk to the mayor if a considerable number, if they call her bluff, and I don't think she can bluff on this. I think she's got to hold firm, or she looks like a real wimp.
Yeah, what's interesting is in the filing, she basically admitted that the union, by refusing to submit this information, is basically saying, we think our health is more important than protecting the city of Chicago, and the city of Chicago is in the middle of a crime wave. So
you're right. I mean, there's ironies on ironies here. I mean, the sworn duty of Chicago police is to enforce the law. Well, this is a law, and they're refusing to follow it. But you are right. There is a risk to the mayor if a considerable number of police defy this and she fires them, and there's a spike in crime. She's going to have to deal with the complications. But I think she's talked herself into a corner here. I don't think she can back off. If the mayor lets these guys off the hook completely now, it will look really bad.
Yeah, the deadline she made slightly less squishy on Thursday by saying, all right, your supervisor, if you don't actually submit, is going to reach out to you to say, why haven't you submitted? Give us this information. So it's not as if the deadline is so hard that this weekend it'll be a crisis.
That's her wiggle room when we enforce it.
Right.
Watching all of it play out has been interesting, like on both sides. But I thought Catanzaro's video message to FOP members was really interesting. I mean, there was some language in there that was, I thought, pretty, I don't know if threatening's the word, but it was pretty bold language.
Well, many of you are getting phone calls, whether you're on furlough or on the medical or IOD right now, from sergeants and lieutenants. That was a department directive. Those lieutenants are simply following the department order. They're putting together spreadsheets so officers can't say, I didn't know. They're documenting the date and time that you were notified. So again, it's no big deal. It's harassing, I know. It's a pain in the ass. But it's the city's clear attempt to force officers to Chicken Little, the sky is falling, into compliance.
But I also thought it was interesting how he was mentioning that there's this third option. There's the conscientious objector sort of route he's offering union members.
The other thing that is unresolved from the week is that in that first video on Tuesday, Catanzaro said he was going to go to court for relief from the city's mandate itself. And I checked in with him the next day and he hadn't filed it, hadn't heard anything Thursday, hadn't heard anything Friday. So I do wonder if this is all just going to play out back and forth in court. Judges have granted preliminary injunctions to kind of press pause, and those typically last 10 days. And that's not necessarily the court saying, yes, I agree with you, Fraternal Order of Police, or whoever is suing to say, grant me this relief. It's saying, I need to study this more. And this might just come down to, was the FOP bargaining in good faith? And if you talk to either of them, they both say no. So Catanzaro would say the city's being unreasonable. Lightfoot would say Catanzaro refused to show up at bargaining sessions and kept on delaying and delaying and delaying until we got closer to the deadline.
AD is right that you never know what a judge is going to do. But if you look at the pattern in Illinois courts in suits involving Governor Pritzker over his mask mandates and the like, and his shutdown orders, the courts have sided with the governor, except in a case of a couple. courts in far southern Illinois with has much different politics than Chicago. The mayor of Chicago has great influence over who gets elected as judge. People who work with her, other folks do. Without predicting for sure, I would be surprised if in the end, the core principle of does the mayor have the right to impose orders like this gets overturned in a local jurisdiction. It may take a while to get there though.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see that play out. In the meantime, AD, you have also been following the topic of casinos, and six firms want to open casinos in the suburbs, question mark?
In the suburbs, period. One in Waukegan and one in the south suburbs, site undetermined. They made presentations to the Illinois Gaming Board earlier this week, basically saying, we are the best. We have the most diverse ownership. We are going to deliver the most revenue to the city and the state. We are going to create the most jobs, either from construction jobs or permanent folks working. We are going to deliver the prettiest hotel, the best resort, all the greatest amenities. We have partnerships with X, Y, and Z local elected official. We will not know for sure. And I should rewind and say this whole process has been backlogged for years now. It was 2.5 years ago that Governor J.B. Pritzker signed legislation expanding casinos in the city and state for the purpose of essentially getting more money for infrastructure. COVID has delayed things somewhat. Certain economic analyses have delayed things somewhat, but this is kind of the first signals that the Gaming Board is starting up in earnest again and allowing things to go forward. So there were two applications for the Waukegan site, four applications for the site in the south suburbs. The Gaming Board is going to convene on the 20th and eliminate one of those south suburban competitors. And then we should have an answer about the ultimate winners in Waukegan and the south suburbs by early next year.
I think what's equally interesting with who did bid is who didn't bid, particularly for Waukegan.
Yeah.
Neil Blum, the Chicago billionaire who runs Rivers Casino, or his company runs Rivers Casino, had long been considered certainly a front runner, one of the front runners up in Waukegan. Well, he announced a couple of weeks ago that he was tired of all this wasting of time and wasn't going to bid for Waukegan anymore. There's a different school of thought on that that says that Neil Blum has decided he really wants the Chicago casino, the RFP, the bids for that are due toward the end of this month, and he's going to put all his chips on Chicago. We'll see if that story plays out, but it certainly made a difference in everybody else bidding in Waukegan now is in the competition. They got a shot.
Yeah, one of the bidders for Waukegan actually said, after Rivers pulled out, we expanded our bid to make it a little bit bigger now that we know that Neil's not in the game. But Greg, I want to know your thoughts on kind of the broader, I don't want to call it conspiracy, but line of conversation that Blum has some interest in the future of Arlington Heights and what will happen with the Bears.
Yeah, we don't have enough time. The people close to some of the other sports owners are vehemently upset that Neil Blum has put a brick on their plans to open sports books at Sox Park and Soldier Field and whatever, because he wants to make sure that his Chicago casino is the big winner and doesn't have any competition. He denies that, and there's lots of screaming, yelling back and forth. But there's no question that his part ownership through his companies of Churchill Downs, which owns Arlington Park, and the fact that the Bears leaving Chicago has all sparked any kind of numbers of conspiracy theories as to what he's really up to. Is Arlington, are the Bears going to get a gambling casino up there or not? Or does Neil Blum not want it? Can't answer any of those. You know as well as I do, AD, because you asked him the questions. Most recently, he just kind of smiles sweetly and saying he's just doing what's right.
Yep. Well, I asked him, so his companies have an official partnership with the Bears to be their sportsbook partner. But I said, are you interested in putting a physical sportsbook at Soldier Field? And he said, no, because it's unlike Wrigley, unlike Sox Park, it's cut off from regular foot traffic. People aren't going to want to go to Soldier Field to watch a different game outside of the sports season. And the reason sportsbooks do well is they function as regular bars and you can go there and bet on a bunch of different stuff. However, if the Bears set up at Arlington Heights and create a new community with a sports book and shops and houses and retail. That's a much more attractive place to do your betting. So very interested in what Bloom does down the line.
I feel like there's so many just kind of wait and sees happening right now.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The tangled webs we weave.
Indeed. All right. Now is the time for us to look to three stories that were not on your beat, but that had your attention in recent days. Who would like to start?
I'll take a crack at it.
Go for it.
This Alice Through the Looking Glass world we're into on COVID and what to do about COVID. I mean, you can't pick up a story, a newspaper, or watch TV or radio, listen, cast anywhere in the country, but there isn't a story about some weird response and what's going on, what's not going on. There was a story yesterday that some Texas legislator who's very prominent in opposing requirements that airline passengers wear masks, came down with COVID to the hospital. Is he going to have a deathbed epiphany here? Don't know. There are other stories like that all over the country. It kind of lost in that is the reality that almost all of us now have moved in that direction. Nationally, we're approaching 80% of adults, people over 18, having at least one vaccination. But there's that hardcore, and you see it in this fight between the mayor and the police union over where they're going to go along and how big of a health risk that presents to everybody else. You know, but it sure is emblematic of the country we live in now, where we have not only we divided, we don't even know we can't even agree on a set of facts. Are the vaccines good or are they not good? Is it a good idea that we take them or not? I mean, did somebody win the election or didn't win the election? It's how do you run a country or a city like that?
Yeah, that continues to be frustrating. I agree. You can't look anywhere without kind of seeing that COVID debate playing out. Indeed. What else caught your attention this week, Greg?
I'll rest on that one. AD, what do you got?
I am very interested in this political headline. Can Pete Buttigieg have it all? And it's about our Secretary of Transportation, former mayor of my hometown of South Bend, going on paternity leave as the country is debating this infrastructure bill. So everyone is used to Pete now being omnipresent on cable news, arguing his point. He's especially good at sparring with folks on Fox. So as President Biden was arguing for this infrastructure bill to get through Congress, everyone kind of expected Pete to be all over TV. Instead, he is home with his husband, Chasten, taking care of their newborn. And I love that we are now asking this question, can so-and-so have it all, which is usually about women being able to work and have a family, about a man, and kind of a broader debate about the future of maternal and paternal leave and other benefits for working people in the COVID era. I'm glad that this debate is being applied to a guy, and we can talk about work-family life balance for both genders.
I can just see you smiling at the prospect of Mayor Pete doing diaper duty.
Yeah. I smell the prospect of all men sharing domestic responsibilities. Another one I loved was a picture-heavy story from Dennis Rodkin about what the fancy condos look like at Tribune Tower. Amy, you and I have met at that building about a billion times, and it is very bizarre to see it now. I don't know how you feel about Trib Tower now being $8 million home.
I know. That was my question to Dennis. I said, when you were walking through it, could you tell where you were? And he worked in the building less. I mean, I was in that building almost every day for years.
Yeah.
And he said, you know, no, because I wasn't in the building as much, but some of the amenities, you know, in the pictures, I was like, I kind of feel like that window used to be a conference room. I kind of feel like that's where this happened. I kind of feel like where this was.
Yeah.
And I think it was really interesting. What I am heartened by, though, is that the lobby is the same.
Amy, if you want, I'll consult my favorite medium and see if we can get the colonel to haunt your current office.
I don't want the colonel to haunt me. I don't want him haunting me. But I'm in favor of consulting favorite mediums, for sure.
Yeah, seeing what the lobby looks like, I remember being a baby reporter and having my first radio appearances on WGN and nervously waiting on the little leather seats outside the floor level WGN radio studios where you could walk by and people live on radio. And now that it's just going to be like rich people walking through there and no longer.
Now it's a fancy couch
sitting
there.
Now it's a fancy couch and it's not meant for broke baby reporters. It's meant for like rich people visitors.
Yeah. I appreciate that the quotes are still up in the lobby, because I think that was part of it. You walk in that lobby and you kind of can't help but realize the weight of it and the weight of the building of going, think of all the people that walked in and all the news they broke and all the huge headlines over the last almost 100 years that existed and that came out of this building. And I think that never went away. Every day walking in, that never went away to me.
Dewey Beach, Truman, just remember, famous headlines.
I know, there's that. They weren't always accurate headlines, but they were headlines. Indeed. All right, what else is on your list, AD?
My third one is soft news, culture news. Kumail Nanjiani gave an extensive interview with Vulture about his transformation into a Marvel superhero and how he was insecure as a kid about being chubby, first-generation kid, and how he thought if he got really fit, his life would change in a certain number of ways. But instead, it made him kind of hyper aware of his body and didn't fix any of his insecurities, as I think many people who go on crash diets or transformation diets experience. But it gets into some really interesting things about masculinity, diet culture, Instagram culture, and the influence of social media on people's perceptions of themselves. So strongly recommend this Kumail profile in Vulture.
Interesting. Well, my three were, I also liked that Buttigieg piece. I thought that was really interesting. But Crane's reported about this a little bit, but also CNBC had a piece about how Best Buy is pushing into healthcare strategy or deeper into healthcare by acquiring Current Health. And at first you're thinking, like, what do TVs and healthcare have to do with each other? But they're kind of making the case that who better than us knows how to put technology into your life and home. So that's kind of interesting to watch them move in that direction with wearables and things like that. There was an interesting piece from AP about how As Seen on TikTok is the new As Seen on TV, and how retailers are, it's so interesting how retailers are kind of pushing that. Even like Barnes & Noble is saying like As Seen on BookTok, and how even candy manufacturers are pushing things as seen on TikTok, but how quickly they have to respond to that because they have to respond in viral speed as something, if an influencer posts something, they have to respond really quickly to that. I thought that was fascinating.
Yes.
But another one on my list of how the world has changed that I kept thinking about, like, what a weird time to be alive was the billionaire space race continues to be bizarre to me. But Prince William speaking out, it was pretty widely reported that he was speaking out against saying like, hey, I realize that all this is happening in space, but maybe pay attention to the planet here. But the piece in particular was Elon Musk becoming the wealthiest person in the world and trolling Jeff Bezos on Twitter about it. I was just like, what a time to be alive. Like, what's happening right now?
Well, there's like the larger argument that, like, if you think about NASA, the way people felt about NASA in the space race way back when, this is different. This is like just billionaires flexing against each other.
It's absolutely
not doing anything to further our understanding of outer space or exploration. It's just like billionaires flexing.
You know, it does make you wonder whether Musk's idea for a tunnel underneath the Kennedy Expressway between downtown Chicago and O'Hare for an express train, that idea died when Rahm Emanuel, who was pushing it, left office. But, you know, it makes you wonder, given this guy's success in every other part of his life professionally, whether maybe he was on to something. But, you know, I don't think we're ever going to find out because he's moved on too.
Yeah, he's moved on. Again, strange times. But while I have you both, speaking of cranes and politics and podcasts, I hear there are new things in the air. Tell me what's happening.
On Monday, Cranes will be launching Juice, which is a series of daily newsletters, along with a live stream between me and Greg that I think will sound a lot like this episode, talking about the week that was in politics. So beginning Monday, you'll get a weekly rundown of what's about to happen in the city, county, and state. On Tuesdays, you'll get a podcast episode from me talking to politicos and newsmakers. The rest of the week, you'll get a DC preview from our friend Dan Vock about what matters in Illinois in DC. You'll also get a Springfield preview from Greg and I. And on Fridays, like I said, the live stream. So it's just content, tons of content coming at you.
I love it. More AD and Greg. I'm all over it. I love it. It's great.
Just remember, AD is the brains of this operation. I'm the
president. Noted. All right. Well, thank you both. I appreciate your time today.
Thanks, Amy.
Coming up, Loyola is quitting fossil fuel investments. The Catholic University's public commitment follows years of campus activism and illustrates the growing social influence of climate change in endowment management. We'll talk about that and more right after this. Is your student taking the SAT, ACT, or a high school admissions test this year? Academic Approach wants to help them get prepared. Academic Approach's time-tested tutoring programs ensure students grow their academic skills, improving their performance on standardized tests. The work together begins with a consultation with an Academic Approach director, who will meet with you and your student to discuss their unique needs. Then Academic Approach creates an effective, fully customized study plan that targets their goals and matches them with a tutor who will be by their side, guiding them through instruction and practice throughout their tutoring journey. Get in touch today to learn how Academic Approach can help your student transform into a confident, successful test taker. Learn more at academicapproach.com/dailygist.
This is the Crane's Daily Gist with Amy Guth.
A former Boeing pilot has been charged with deceiving U.S. aviation regulators in the first prosecution related to two fatal 737 MAX crashes that sparked crisis for the plane maker. The Justice Department said in a statement that Mark Forkner, a former chief technical pilot for the company, was indicted Thursday on charges that he deceived the FAA's aircraft evaluation group during the agency's evaluation and certification of the plane. He's accused of providing the FAA with false, inaccurate, and incomplete information about a new part of the flight controls for the aircraft. Due to his alleged actions, plane manuals and pilot training materials for U.S. Airlines didn't have any reference to the software system that was later linked to both crashes. The case is the result of a criminal investigation that started in late 2018 after the first of two crashes that combined killed 346 people and sparked the longest grounding of a commercial jetliner in U.S. aviation history. Forkner is charged with two counts of fraud involving aircraft parts and interstate commerce, and four counts of wire fraud. If convicted, he faces as long as 20 years in prison for each count of wire fraud and 10 years for each count of fraud involving aircraft parts and interstate commerce. Hundreds of thousands of people in Illinois could lose health insurance under Medicaid next year when the state resumes eligibility reviews that were suspended during the pandemic. Annual so-called redeterminations of Medicaid eligibility were paused last year when the federal government declared COVID-19 a public health emergency. As a result, Medicaid enrollment in the state grew almost 30% to 2.7 million. And those numbers are now expected to drop when redeterminations start up again after the emergency declaration expires on December 31st. Crane's healthcare reporter Stephanie Goldberg has the story in detail.
Illinois' Medicaid membership is expected to drop when eligibility reviews start up again after the federal public health emergency declaration expires. Cook County Health predicts that enrollment in its Medicaid managed care plan will fall 10% between now and September 2022 if redeterminations resume early next year. If the state's five other private Medicaid plans see similar percentage declines, more than 270,000 people would lose coverage under the government-funded health insurance program. Industry observers say many people are expected to lose coverage not because they're no longer eligible, but because they fill out redetermination forms incorrectly or fail to respond to notices, which are sometimes mailed to the wrong address.
Chicago-based cannabis firm Cresco Labs is buying Pennsylvania-based Laurel Harvest for $80 million. That according to Crane's sister publication, Green Market Report. Laurel will provide Cresco Labs thousands of square feet of growing and processing space in Pennsylvania, as the company has 52,000 square feet of room for indoor growing and processing and room for an additional 52,000 square feet of indoor cultivation space. Laurel also has a dispensary in Montgomery, Pennsylvania, and is building a second in Scranton. Pennsylvania is a medical use only state. The acquisition is expected to close before the end of the year. Loyola University Chicago announced that it plans to divest from companies that contribute to climate change. The new policy will end direct investments and wind down commitments in companies that derive most of their revenue from fossil fuels. Instead, Loyola said it will prioritize investing in funds or companies working to reduce carbon emissions. The move follows years of activism by both faculty and students, urging the university to use its influence to combat climate change. According to advocacy website Fossil Free, more than 1,300 institutions, including schools, nonprofits, government groups, and corporations, have announced similar divestment policies. At Loyola, Chief Investment Officer Catherine Wyatt estimated that about 2.5% of the school's more than $228 million endowment is invested in the fossil fuel sector. She said she expects investments in coal, oil, and gas to shrink almost completely by 2025, but told Cranes there are still some contracts in place that will need time to expire. That's Cranes Daily Gist for now. Check in on our continuous news feed at chicagobusiness.com. Thanks so much to both of my guests today, Cranes political columnist Greg Hines and government reporter A.D. Quigg. You can follow all of our conversations on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get audio on demand. And remember to rate and review Cranes Daily Gist because that's the best way for others to discover our episodes. You'll also find hashtag Cranes Daily Gist on Twitter, Facebook, and LinkedIn. Our show is produced by Todd Manley at Earsight Studios. I'm Amy Guth. Thanks so much for listening, and I'll meet you right back here next time.